Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Renee. Welcome back to Renee's Heart to Heart. Thanks for coming by today. I'm going to bring Shelley in right away because I kind of changed the show today because of a meeting I had yesterday. Good morning, Shel.
Good morning, Renee.
How are you?
I'm doing real good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. Go ahead. I met with a young man yesterday by the name of Jacob, and he is the director of Desert Rose. Desert Rose is a recovery house, a transitional house, if you will. At this point in time, he just takes in women, girls, women. On his card, I love this. It says, Desert Rose, Ashes to Beauty. And he has a place here in Palm Beach that already has 10 girls in it. And a lot of the women that he has come from up north, come for some sunshine, a little vitamin D, and the healing attributes that Florida can offer that you can't get, especially this past winter in the northern states. But we had a long talk, and it's been a long time since I've met somebody who is really just thinking about making the world a better place. He didn't talk to me once about how much money he makes, which is what I usually hear. He talked to me about the fact that it makes him heartsick to realize that a lot of these young people, mom and dad have insurance, and they're welcome at all of these. Some of these places cost people $10,000, $20,000 a month, Shelley. Can you believe that?
No, I can't. I had no idea.
Insurance will pay for it if mom and dad have got good insurance. So, but the deal is once the insurance runs out, once the monies that have been contributed to that part of the policy, they're out on their own, unless mom and dad want to start paying, out of their checkbook. So, what ends up happening, of course, I'm sure you know this without me saying it, and so does anybody else listening, a lot of times, after 6 months, somebody's still not ready. It depends on what the deal is. It depends on what the addiction is. It depends on who the person is. There's so many, factors in how long it takes anybody to become addicted and how long it takes anybody to become unaddicted, right? I mean, that's kind of a given.
And the deeper thing here is that just because somebody has a propensity or a predisposition to become an addict, they only become an addict if the sociological, which means the things that affect them from society in their life, if there's occurrences in their life that basically push them in that direction. So just having the ability to become an addict because you have the gene or because you're genetically predisposed doesn't mean you will. So you have to look at why they became an addict, not just the fact that they are one now. What put them in there? What family dynamic? What tragedy? What personality makeup? What put them in that position? And you have to help them, work with that and either get past it or deal with it in a way that doesn't constantly rebound them back into the old behavior.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we also have to think about what the end result is, how far it brought them, how long they've been addicted, to what they've been addicted, and how much of their life it has consumed. So
right. Obviously,
there are some people who could overcome an addiction that they just you know, fell into probably in 90 days in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth of the matter is that after the 90 days of getting over the itch, then you have to do something about what makes you itch, right?
Right,
and,
exactly.
And that's the tricky part. Now, you and I and several of our friends have talked about these kind of addictions on many occasions, not just on the show, but privately. In the Institute, we addressed every now and then someone would show up and maybe been clean for a couple weeks, but then they come to a place like an Institute that we were at, and so many of the other crutches are taken away, the pot of coffee, the cigarettes, the Twinkies, the chocolate candy, all of those things that help them get off the addiction. And most of the time, the things I just mentioned are replacements to almost any kind of addiction. So you bring them to a place like the Institute, and you take away all that stuff too. So in the perfect picture, you'd be doing them a big favor because you're going to fill them back up with good things instead of the things I just mentioned.
Right.
And very rarely does it work like that. I had several occasions when I had to make calls and place people in other areas of Florida to get them the kind of help that they really needed, often a 12-step program. I know people have mixed emotions about the kind of programs that really keep people in a clean place. There's a lot of talk about 12 steps, and we've talked about it on the show. We've gone over the 12 steps. We've talked about the benefits of some people needing that written protocol, and we get that. But some people don't. You know, again, we're all so different. What works for one often doesn't work for another. But the part that I kind of want to talk about today is this place that this young man and his wife have organized, and it's the transitional housing. It's after somebody has gotten off the drugs or the alcohol, after they've detoxed, after they've gone through a program, however long it took to get them to a place where the powers that be believe that they're clean and sober, really clean and sober. So then what they need is a place to transition back into the mainstream of life and do it without a lot of stress and maybe even learn other things during that transitional time, other things that are healthier, other things that can take the place, good habits that can take the place of bad. And we know of a lot of things, a lot of positive things that help all of us. Shelley and I boost each other's morale on a weekly basis.
True.
When Shelley and I are going through something, which, you know, life throws curves to all of us on every day sometimes, and sometimes it seems like, oh, my God, what did I do to deserve all this? You need somebody that isn't a family member, because a lot of times they're in that problem sequence. So you have to have somebody you can talk to. And Shelley and I have done that for each other for a long time now.
It's
but
true.
Like, if I'm really feeling dumpy, like, I, you know, oh, my God, do I have to do this again? Or, oh, my God, is this happening to me again? She always reaffirms the positive side of Renee. When she's in that place, that's what I try to do for her. So, and a lot of the things that we learned in the last 15 years, we play into making those kind of adjustments in our own mindsets.
Right.
Thinking positively, Shelley is Shelley turned a corner not very long ago, a major corner for Shelley, and she embraced the positive part of life. She can pull herself out now just by putting out there, I'm going to be fine, and this is going to work out good, and I'm just going to think about the good things that can happen instead of letting myself be yanked into an abyss by all the negativity. Because that can happen to all of us, and
right.
We don't want it to happen. If you can visualize a big hole, I mean, we see it on a lot of scary movies, this visualization, that's probably why it comes to my head, of arms reaching out in a dark hole, trying to pull you in there with them. Because misery loves company, everybody. It really loves company. So if you let yourself fall into that abyss, there has to be somebody on the top of this abyss that grabs your hand and says, you don't belong in there. Come on. So these are some of the things that we can do for people if we have an opportunity. And these are some of the things that you can do for each other when you have that
And sometimes somebody has gotten themselves in that place and they're so deep in there and they have so many hands holding on to them that they don't even realize they're in an abyss. They're so preoccupied. They're so distracted and overwhelmed by the circumstances of their life that they don't even recognize. Number one, they don't even recognize that they've kind of gotten themselves stuck in a bad place. And if they do realize it, they don't see that there's a way out, because it's like you don't see the forest for the trees cliche. And that's another reason why it's imperative to have, even if it's just one other person, somebody who can give you a different perspective, who can just grab you by the shoulders and turn you around and say, look, there's light at the end of the tunnel. You're looking in the wrong direction. Look over here. There is a solution. There is a way out. Things are going to get better. And sometimes all you need is that one person that's firmly telling you in a way that you can believe, that's either authoritative or kind or but the person that's speaking to you is somebody that's speaking in a way that's believable, and they catch your attention. And again, you and I have both been there where we've gotten ourselves in the middle of something that was just completely taking us over, very distracted, very preoccupied, and we've both been overwhelmed a couple of times by certain things that have happened to us. And because we had the other one to lean on or other family members or other situations, but a lot of times it was each other, you were able to just turn your head and just look in a slightly different direction, and all of a sudden there was the solution, or there was hope, or there was light at the end of the tunnel, something along those lines.
Well, and very sadly, knowing those things that we both just shared about ourselves, we also can see the other side of the story, the person that is enveloped in a family, a group, friends, relatives, whoever they are, that are comfortable in that abyss.
Mm-hmm.
Comfortable. They've made it their home. And they actually, they survive there. They do it with lots of negativity, lots of anger, lots of issues in their relationships with others, but they actually make it their home. So it's hard. You know, it's like that old cartoon, you know, the devil on one shoulder and the angel on the other. We even talked this week about paranormal and demons and all that kind of stuff. There's a lot out there to decipher. There's a lot of information out there, so that a lot of times we are our own physician, our own counsel, our own protection. And that's not always good. I mean, I want everybody to stand on their own 2 feet. Don't misunderstand. And I want everybody to be strong and have a constitution that is strong and be able to, you know, call their own shots. That's the perfect world. But I also don't want you to fool yourself into believing that you're in a good place when you're not. And you can usually tell by the way things are going for you. So this transitional housing, I think, is the answer to a very age-old issue. And that is the fact that when you take some poor soul who has fallen into that abyss and pull them out and get them clean and sober, get them with a little bit of positivity in their life, get them understanding that, yes, there are people that they can trust. The whole world is not made up of evil. There are good people out there. There are good things going on. There are places to go where you can be happy and content. Then you send them out on their own again. But old habits die hard. And old feelings die hard. I dare say anybody that's over the age of 40 can take them to a place, if they're sitting all alone, can take them to a place that will bring tears to their eyes. If they remember something that happened to them, if they remember a place they were, a dark time in their lives, whatever. And if you're out there alone and you don't have a Shelley or a Rini to call on the phone and say, I am having a crappy day, then they need that transitional house. They need that place for several days. This young man would like to make this kind of transitional living 12 months long. And I said to him, I said, that seems like an awful long time, you know, when I think of a year. But when I think of a person who is trying to change their whole life, and some of these women that we're talking about are in their 50s, some older, some a lot younger, but a year in the big picture really isn't a lot of time.
No, it's not, and it's because you're talking about making major changes in their habit patterns. Because for good or bad, the way they were living, the way they were thinking, the way they were thinking that got them where they were to begin with is very ingrained in them. Even if you're talking about somebody in their 30s, and if you're talking about an individual that's older than that, it's a habit for them to think the way they think. So a year in the whole scheme of things really isn't a long time to shift that. You know, 6 months, I don't believe, is long enough just based on that. You know, because you're actually shifting a way a person looks at life. You're shifting a way a person views what happens to them. And I think a lot of it goes to kind of, like you said, everything we talk about somehow affects everything else we talk about. What we talked about today with bullies to buddies. A lot of people that become drug addicts are victims or believe they're victims, and they're turning to drugs so that they can artificially instill a feeling of control and euphoria in their lives. They feel good while they're high. They feel in control. They feel better about things because in their general way of going about life, they feel dread, they feel out of place, they feel bad about themselves, they feel fearful, whatever, right? So they're getting high, and it's this vicious cycle they get them on. But if they could learn to take responsibility for their lives, to have better coping mechanisms, and not to fall into this victim mentality, then they would lose that trigger that would make them want to go back on the drugs. And that takes a while to train the brain not to automatically go into victim mode again. You know, so a year is actually a very good time, but a year may not even be long enough. They may need continual help after that, but it would certainly get them further along than 6 months, no doubt.
Yeah. Well, and the way Jacob is talking, of course, is one of the other things that I think is very, very beneficial and I think will help everybody, and I base this on another program at the Institute. They're called Health Educators. And of all of the graduates that I've ever seen come out of the Institute, the health educators are hands down the most comfortable with their lifestyle changes. They are the most they're the most successful ones. And they often stay even, I mean, the program is 9 weeks, but they often stay longer than that. And I will tell you, in the years I have been in touch with many graduates from the Institute, people who stayed 3-6 weeks, sometimes have been back and forth many, many occasions. But it's the ones that form relationships with others so that they've got that hand or that voice or that connection to talk to every now and then, and they survive that way. The same way with AA. I mean, the only way and the only reason, in my eyes, that AA has been so successful is because of the sponsorship program.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, yeah, you get to depend on somebody who's been in your shoes, and you see that they're dependable. You see that they are really a friend and that they really care. And there isn't anything more inviting, exciting, and heartwarming to a human being than to know they've really found somebody who cares about them.
Right. And the fact that they're being coached, directed, they're being led by somebody who was at one time where they are now. So the level of credibility is there. It's not like I'm coming in and I've never had an issue with drugs or alcohol ever in my life, and I'm telling you, you can do this. Well, how would I know? You know, and so that's why it's imperative that it's somebody that's gone through this. And because they have, you know, if you have somebody who's a recovering addict of some sort, speaking to somebody now who's in the throes of addiction, and they can say, look, and they can start sharing stories. This is what happened to me, and look at me now. And now they're looking at somebody, you know, who's dressed well, who's articulate, who seems to have it all together, and they think, wow, well, if they can do it, I can do it. And it lends that level of believability, of credibility, and they can latch onto it. So it is imperative that the counselors be somebody that have gone through it. You know, same thing like at the Institute, you know. A lot of the counselors were people that were living that lifestyle. So it was very easy for them to tell people, hey, look, this is how I live. And I, like, when I was a counselor at the Institute, I lived this way. I healed my body in 2.5 years by becoming a raw foodist. And when I used to explain this to people, it would lend credibility to the program. It was very easy for me to suggest this to people because I just told them my own personal story, and they could latch on to that and say, okay, well, I guess there is something real about this, you know. And so I think that's very, very important when you're talking about AA or places like this, that you're dealing with people who went through it, got through it, and now they're counseling others. And it also strengthens that person now because they have a deep and beneficial purpose to their life, and it keeps the counselors in a good place. Because remember, they're always vulnerable also.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the other thing that everybody has to remember is the fact that addiction in all shapes and sizes. So when what we see happen a lot is when somebody gives up one thing, they find something else that takes its place. And it's our hope that whatever they find to take its place is healthy, good for them, and beneficial for their life. But that's not always true. I'm always...
You know, I had a personal experience with somebody who got themselves in a good place but didn't do it properly and it didn't hold. I had a friend when I lived in New York. We were best friends for about 12 years. And when I first met her, she was clean. I never knew she had a drug problem. We became best friends. And a couple of years into the friendship, she started having some traumas in her life that kind of brought her back to a bad place. And that's when I found out she had been a heroin addict when she was in her teens. She was a heroin addict for years. She was actually institutionalized. But she had such a strong mind, and she was extremely intelligent. I mean, I know she had a genius IQ. She was extremely intelligent, but she was dysfunctional. She was so intelligent that she was actually dysfunctional. But she was very personable, very professional. She was working three jobs when I met her. So she really was an overachiever, but she just had all these demons in her head. She had all these things that she had suffered an extremely traumatic event when she was 16, and she, the bottom line is she never recovered it, and her parents never got her help for it. And because she had this predisposition to become an addict, that's where she went to get over this thing that happened to her when she was 16. And she went 20 years clean. Now, like I said, when I met her, she was clean. I never knew she had a drug history. She had been clean for 20 years. She was working three jobs. And then because something happened to her during our friendship that kind of brought her back to a dark place, she ended up going right back on drugs. And within 2 years, she was actually back on heroin. Now, this is as an adult, as a businesswoman. And then it took 6 years to completely destroy our friendship because I didn't know then what I know now. Doesn't mean I would have been successful. But I was so naive, I was so ignorant about drug addictions, I didn't know how to help her. I ended up becoming an enabler because we were best friends, and I had a lot of affection for this woman. I wanted to help her, protect her from herself, and everything I did just allowed her to get deeper into the drug use because I didn't know what I was doing. And there was nobody who was a recovering, there was no counselor, anybody who was giving her the appropriate advice. And because I was never an addict myself, I couldn't give her the appropriate advice. I wasn't the appropriate person to help her, but I was the one she always turned to, so it wasn't a good scenario. So it's really important that if you love somebody and they're in that position, unless you're a professional counselor, you're not going to be the one that's going to be able to turn them around. You've got to get them professional help, and you've got to get them professional help from somebody who is also a recovering addict, somebody who really and truly understands what they're going through, because I didn't. And as much as I can philosophically align myself with what's going on here, the bottom line is I'm not the one who's going to be able to help an addict.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't necessarily believe that you didn't help. I think maybe you didn't have all the answers because your experience was limited. But
I became an enabler. So what I did is I just allowed the situation to perpetuate itself. But that's the problem. When you care about somebody like that so much, and I was trying to help her, but everything I did to help her, which was all well-intentioned on my part, okay, made it easier for her to just continue the addiction, to continue getting into that lifestyle. Because I assisted her in getting other areas of her life in order. My thought process would that if I took the stress off of her and helped her follow through with things that were her obligations, then she wouldn't need to turn to the drugs. But what it did is it allowed her to turn to the drugs more because she saw that her house was being taken care of, her kids were being taken care of. So, and that's kind of the enabler relationship, the codependency. She needed me to do that so that she could get deeper into this hole, and here I'm thinking I'm helping her come out of the hole, and I was just helping her go deeper into it, you know. And it took me a long time to come to terms with that, but that's when I realized that I wasn't going to be the person that was going to help her turn around, but she and I were codependent on each other, and that sort of a relationship that evolves when you're dealing with that. That's why I've come to such a new respect for people that become, you know, people that were addicts, that got themselves clean and now go into counseling. That is such a needed venue, for lack of a better way of putting it, you know, because you're going to be able to now take what you succeeded in and help other people turn their lives around.
Well, I think On that note, there are, as we've talked about so many times before, many kinds of addictions. And I don't think the addictions have to be the same to be beneficial to help somebody. But I do think, first and foremost, you have to care. And even though you did make mistakes during that time, Shell, I think that during that time, if you weren't doing the things that you did do, she would have met her demise. Because it would have been overwhelming for her. So you still, even though you feel like you didn't do everything perfect and you didn't solve what you thought was the biggest problem, which was her addiction to the drugs, you still were in the right place at the right time because you still brought her through something that she wouldn't have made it through if you weren't there. And I know, because I know this story, there were other people involved as well. So I don't think you deserve to not feel proud of what you did during that time, even though I understand that you're looking at it analytically like you look at everything.
Well, and I'm also looking at the final outcome, which is basically that her life crashed and burned. I mean, she ended up ODing.
Where were you going?
On binges, you know.
Where were you? Where were you when that happened?
I was living with her. I had an apartment in her house downstairs. That's what destroyed our friendship, because when she started going on these drug binges, she became violent, and that's what ended our friendship. I'm living in her house, and she physically attacked me 3 times when I confronted her about her drug use.
I know. But when she finally met her demise, where were you?
I was living in her house.
You were still in her house when she died?
Well, no, she didn't die. I thought she had died, but I found out recently that I think she's living upstate Ocala, Florida. I thought she had passed away because I had been told by a friend of a friend that she ended up developing lung cancer. But as of 2 years ago, I found her living upstate Florida in Ocala. So I think she's still alive, but she was very diseased. She was a very angry, bitter person, and she lost her house. I know that. So her life did disintegrate. Health-wise, she's permanently crippled on her right leg. I mean, this was everything that I knew about her at the time that our friendship broke up. And but I found out things afterwards. She never had a happy life, and I think it's tragic because I think she could have had a happy life. She had a brilliant mind, which was one of the things that always tore me apart. That's how we became friends. She just had this incredibly brilliant mind, and before she got back on drugs, we could just sit and talk for hours. And back and forth, you know. She liked to hear things I said. I liked to hear things she said. We really, really were best of friends for about 6 years. And the drugs just really altered her personality. But because I was already good friends with her, I tolerated it and tried to work with her for another 6 years. And then it ultimately ended very violently. But, yeah, I was living at her house when she had her at that time when she almost had a seizure. I ended up getting her to the hospital. She was in ICU for 3 weeks. She lost use of one of her legs because of the seizure and things like that. I mean, she really messed herself up, but that's why I was living with her. She OD'd on heroin, and it did a lot of damage.
Well, like I said, I still think that you were where you needed to be during that time, and things would have spiraled even faster than they did. And of course,
you know what had happened is I tried to have an intervention to get her into one of these centers that we're talking about. I had orchestrated an intervention with two of her other friends, her father, and all that. And the day before the intervention, her father, who's a very wealthy man, I don't know, to this day I've never understood why he did this, he went and he told her that we were going to confront her and that she better get her act together. And this was one of the reasons that she was the way she was. He was more concerned about embarrassing the family than getting her help. And she took off. And then it was about 2 years after that everything finally, she didn't get any help. She got worse. She went more into the drugs. And the rest of us were like, oh, my God, why did he do that? Because it ruined everything. And it's like I've always wondered what would have happened if we could have gone through with the intervention and got her into this center. We had everything all set up, and you know, because she did have a brilliant mind. So it, I always wondered about that. But, you know, but it's like, but I see a lot of these shows, and not everybody that goes through an intervention does get clean, so who knows. But the bottom line is my intentions were good, but in retrospect now, I can see the difference. And that's why I think these type of centers, the reason I was talking about that is because I think these type of centers of this gentleman you're talking about and what he's trying to do is absolutely the way to go. And I think what it does is it gives these people a permanent anchor that even if they're out of the center, they're going to learn lessons there. They're going to learn lessons from people who know what they're going through, not philosophically, but because they've been there. And they have, they're going to have that tie line now to something that gives them a sense of control and security even when they're feeling like they want to use again. You know, they have a person to talk to. They have lessons that they've learned. They went a year where they were more in control of their lives, and it gives them something to grasp onto when life happens again.
Well, the only thing that I have some hesitancy about is that in his mind, they shouldn't have to get a job. They shouldn't have to do anything except for get themselves well. And I applaud that to a certain degree. But I also feel that one of the biggest stressors in all of our lives is our job. And we talked for an hour and a half yesterday, and it got to the point where it was obvious that we both appreciated what the other one had to offer and what the other one thinks about and how they feel about things. But it was also, for me, I thought to myself, you know, he's very young. I mean, young compared to me. And he really has a great mindset in regard to understanding what's going on in the world and wanting to help. He said to me, the biggest criteria for me to find people to help me organize this is that they care. And he said, and from what I understand, that's one of your biggest assets. And I said, I like to think it is. And I said, but I also have to look at reality.
Right.
And you can't carry somebody all the time and then expect them to walk. You just can't.
Is the center that he has, is it registered in any way? Is this a certified program? Is this just something he's doing in a house he has?
No, he's actually been working on getting all of his licenses in order. He's got a clinical department, a medical department. He is looking, as we speak, for a lab. I'm going to help with some of that stuff this week, to get testing done and be able to keep an eye on everybody, and all that stuff is pretty easy to get put together. But his big thing right now is he's negotiating office space. And
how big is the building? Is it a house or is it like a warehouse or is it a commercial building or a home that he's got? Because you said he's got 10 residents.
Yes, he's got 10 residents, and he's also looking at a place that has, his what he's doing is he's hiring house moms and dads, couples, if that's the way they want to do it, or a mom at least, and they get paid to work there. They get their room and board, and they also get 2 days off a week. And it's their job to keep the family running smoothly, which I think is the best idea of anything. I've
Yep.
talked to a lot of people that have got transitional homes, and there's no constant in the home. And I've always been against that. You can't do
yeah,
that.
I agree with that. There has to be some consistency, because that's one of the things that happens to these people is that they don't have consistency in their lives. So they feel vulnerable because of that. So I agree with you on that there has to be some consistency.
Well, and without leadership, Without now, leadership, how do you know which way to go?
Exactly.
I mean,
now, this guy, Josh, is he a recovering addict? Is that why he wants to do this?
His name is Jacob, and no, he's not a recovering addict.
Jacob, I'm sorry.
That's all right. He and his wife, she works and is the clinical director of Place of Hope, and that's another show we're going to have, because he explained to me yesterday that it is enormous. He wants to take me on a tour there. So next week, we're going to make a date, and I'm going to go on a tour at Place of Hope.
And what is Place of Hope for?
It's an orphanage, in essence.
Oh, wow.
It's an orphanage. And there are, you know, like kids from all over. There's a lot of kids. And he says it's beautiful. He said, but what they do is amazing. But one of the things that he was upset about is, you know, when an orphan or a parentless or responsible parentless child turns 18, then they move on. And I said, no, that's not true. And he said, well, he said, you're right. You know, they do. I said, the state of Florida, they get the opportunity to go to school, continue their education that the state of Florida pays for if they are a bona fide orphan. They also get a stipend, which is a lot more than my kids got when they turned 18, by the way.
Exactly.
And I was very when I found that out, gosh, that was probably 3 or 4 years ago when I found that out, because I've been working so closely with Daniel Sohn. And all the kids that are involved with him who are foster kids. Almost everyone that I met with Daniel is in a foster situation. Not now. Now they're adults.
Right.
I was impressed by what we do. But the trick is getting that child to stay within the guidelines. And a lot of times they don't. A lot of times they are still kind of lost. Well, Place of Hope, according to Jacob, has got real good records for the continuum of the kids when they leave there. But he has two children that he adopted that were of age, and that's why he and his wife adopted them. And
so what made him want to this type of a house if he doesn't have any history with drug addiction then?
Well, he didn't really share that with me. I kind of went there a couple times, and he just said, I just think there's a need. And so I told him, you know, my story, and I said, I'm an Irish Catholic, and Irish Catholics drink at everything, and he laughed. He said, yeah. He was raised a Baptist, and he's very, very Christian. And I said, well, when we get to know each other, when we get to know each other better, we'll discuss God. And I said, in my eyes, God is there for all of us, but he doesn't intervene, he doesn't make our decisions for us, and he doesn't clean the roadway for us to walk through. He leaves that up to us. And when you talk about the dependency that you talked about your friend, very sadly, God gets treated like that too and gets blamed for many things. God, why have you forsaken me? He does not forsake you. You screw up all on your own.
That was all about.
Yeah, so he looked at me and shook his head and smiled, and he said, you're right. And I told him the story of Michael, and he got a little bit emotional when he heard that story. And he said, you know, sometimes I don't understand God. And I said, that's because God had nothing to do with that. That was three boys who let their estrogen and their not their estrogen, their
testosterone.
That word would not come to me to save my soul. I was going through the alphabet very quickly. Their testosterone ran away with them. You know, there's no way I believe. It would kill me if I believed that they woke up that morning and said, let's set Mike Brewer on fire. And that would kill me. I know that's not what happened. It just snowballed out of control. And I said, that's why I know. And look at all the tragedies that we hear every day. Look at the one we just read about, and I just put it on my Facebook page. The woman that killed six of her babies, for God's sakes. And I mean that, for God's sakes. It's not about that. It's about the choices we make as human beings, and we're here on this earth. And
it's not that God makes something happen or lets something happen. If you really believe in free will, which is what we have here, then why would God step in? Then it's not free will. If God's going to step in every time somebody's going to do something bad, then we don't have free will. So either you have free will or you don't have free will, you know? And I always find it so frustrating when something bad happens to somebody. They say, why did God let this happen to me? No, that's our lives here. That was the whole purpose of having free will, because people have the free will to do good or bad things. And you have to deal the best you can with what life hands you.
Right.
But another thing is, so in his, I agree with what you said a few minutes ago, by the way, about the fact that these people should be getting jobs while they're going. Now, I can see going a few months without having to have the pressure of a job because they're not stable in the beginning. But at least midway through, I think the occupants should have to get a job in order to be able to remain there for the additional 6 months, because how are they going to be able to transition into that kind of responsibility? In the beginning, it's going to be difficult for them. They would need a center like this to be able to come back to if they have a bad day at work or if they go under stress, so they can develop, you know, they can develop those mechanisms, those coping mechanisms. They can develop how to deal with people when they're not drugged up, you know, deal with coworkers, deal with bosses, deal with difficult customers, and not have to run and get high. So I'm with you on that. I think that he needs to investigate that a little bit further, because I think he's making a mistake if he allows these people to be in a cocoon for 12 months and then all of a sudden say, okay, now go get a job. And now they don't have the security or the support of having this center to go back to anymore.
What do you think about this? This is what I was thinking while he and I were talking. What if the job was at the center? What if the responsibility? I mean, you've got to have responsibilities in a home. I mean, Joshy takes out the garbage every other week. Austin takes it out the other weeks. You know, Spike has to mop the floor on Wednesdays. I mean, I have those kind of things here. So I'm thinking that in the beginning, some responsibilities make us strong and keep us organized.
Yeah, and in a center like that, you're going to need landscaping done, yard work, housekeeping, even cooking. Yeah, so I could see that the different residences would have to be able to take on one of those positions, and that could be it in the beginning, to take on a responsibility. But the bottom line is they're still in friendly territory. So,
yeah,
that would be a good place to get them started, and you could even have them doing that in the first 6 months. And I've heard of some of the centers where they do get responsibilities within the home environment. Okay,
right.
But I just
brought Elise in. She's been wanting to come in for a couple minutes, and I wanted you to finish your thoughts. But good morning, Elise.
So the bottom line is, I do think at some point within that 12 months that they're in the home, that they have to get a job outside. Because now you're talking unfriendly territory. You're talking situations that can really make them feel vulnerable, and I think they have to be exposed to that while they still have the safety and support of the center to come back to.
Mm-hmm. Well,
but yeah, I agree with you that they should get something while they're in the center also in the beginning. I think that's a great idea.
Well, and it, of course, helps support the center, makes the center their
mm-hmm.
home. You know, they take some ownership, which will mean that it gets treated more carefully. A lot of positive things. Good morning, Elise.
I just wanted to add to that Brian After 2.5 weeks, they want to move him into transitional, and that's exactly what they have at the premise where he is. They have an on-site restaurant where they start the older boys with a job while they're going through drug rehab, mental health clinical work. So I think it's an awesome idea that you have here, Rini, and Shelley, you know, for being so vehemently for it. I have to say that so was I when I learned about this.
Well, I think the young man that I'm working with right now, he just has a place for women. And he also seems to, well, because he's immersed in this work now, he sees that there's a big call for middle-aged women. But he also wants to have a place for guys, boys. And I haven't met anybody his age with obviously his lifestyle and everything that I felt so akin to. He really, really, really wants the world to be a better place. And you don't meet a lot of people like that that don't have a bottom line that concerns the world being a better place. Everybody that Elise and I talked to here several months back, you could just feel
the business,
yeah,
money.
and the no heart. I mean, no heart.
Yep.
Just money signs, and of course, this is what Jacob has found out when he started investigating this, that if somebody has good insurance, and if they can pay this astronomical amount of money for so many months, the minute the insurance is gone, so are they. And
yeah,
that really rubs away. Yeah. So, but I do think that this is an answer. It's all right. Go ahead, honey.
I wanted to say that, you know, he's only been there for 2 weeks, and yesterday we had our first therapy session with his therapist, and I saw how she was totally on his page for moving him into the transitional, and then I understood why. Because in addition to them getting the money from all the clinical work that they get, they will now get an extra $1,000 for room, board, and, you know, the food money that gets budgeted to the kids to learn how to shop and then cook for themselves. But I was like, wow, you know, if you've got 4 to 6 kids in a room or, you know, in a condo complex, that's $4,000 to $6,000 a month. You know, that's a lot of money. And if you have that going on, you know, in other buildings or, you know, more than just one set of 4 to 6 people, wow, talk about a cash cow. So
yeah.
I'm a little concerned about this transitional and, you know, what it means. I know nothing about it.
Well, I think, first of all, I know Brian, and I'm a little bit shocked that they are pushing him out after 3 weeks.
Me too.
They're not. You're Brian. They've got him in there in a rehab, and they want to put him in transitional housing after 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Did I understand?
And they'll probably do it at 4 weeks.
So 1 month of detox and sobriety, and then they're going to put them into transitional living.
Correct.
Wow, that doesn't make sense.
That's what I'm wondering. You know, I just got all this information yesterday, and again, it's the bottom line. And, you know, I didn't hear everything that you were saying at the start of this conversation just because I got on late today with the kids and what have you, but I'd like to learn a little bit about what you're talking about because it sounds pretty interesting.
Well, he's already got a house with 10 girls in it, and so far it's working very nicely. He has a house mother that he loves. He says she's warm and loving, but she still, you know, has an iron fist, which is, of course, what a good mom is all about. And she handles it very nicely. And he said, but his idea is that in the transitional housing that they're there for 12 months. And he doesn't want them to have to get jobs on the outside. He wants them to continue that 1 year of support and organization and all the things that go with transitioning into a sober lifestyle in the outside world. And I agree with everything he said, except for I feel like if you keep them for a year and then tell them, okay, now you got to go get a job, I don't know, there's like a stop there for me. And but we just met. I mean, we've talked on the phone several times, but we just met yesterday and talked for about an hour and a half. I love him. I think that he is warm and caring, purely wants to make a difference. He wants to save some of these kids. I said to him, the first time we talked, I said, you know, people talk about this all the time. There is a throwaway person. There is no such thing as that. We are all worth something.
That's
everybody.
Right.
And just because somebody has fallen into the abyss that Shelley and I were talking about at the beginning of the show doesn't mean that's where they're supposed to stay.
Right.
It's a human being. And I don't need to know somebody to know that it's okay to throw them away. So, and that's the way he believes. So I'm going to work on this. Right now he's trying to lock down an office space. Once he does that, then we're going to have some meetings and organize a team. But and right now, like I said, he doesn't he just takes women. But he wants to open the doors and wants to have several places. Our dream would be to have a place like Hippocrates, a campus like that, where we could there at the same time. And the other thing that he's in favor of, which is something that we talk about on the show, is being able to teach new stuff about their body, stuff about their health, stuff about their mental capacity, stuff about learning, stuff about caring, stuff about taking care of someone else so that they want you in their life. He wants to have them all those things, and I think that's great.
Good. I'll be there with my algae, with the new field of study, optogenetics. I told you about that the other day, right?
Yep. Well, and I know that any place that is going to do the right things for people, there will have to be supplemental nourishment, for sure. Mm-hmm. Of course, blue-green algae is up there at the top of the list, as well as, and he's all for that. He said, it doesn't have to be quite as rigid as a raw food institute. There are many things that can be brought in. Like I said to Shelley in the beginning of the show today, you know, you take away alcohol, and in my history at the institute, I would have to send people to a 12-step program and then bring them back. Because when
right.
you get sober and come there and they couldn't have coffee, they couldn't smoke their cigarettes, they couldn't have a Twinkie, they couldn't get a sugar fix, they couldn't survive there. So there has to be the right timing. But
right.
we're about the time. I want to remind everybody that tomorrow, of course, is recap day, so we'll talk a little bit about this again, but I'm going to want to explain to everybody about the big thing that Shelley and I are going to tomorrow. It's Okay to Talk, sponsored by the Mental Health Association of Palm Beach County, and all connected. Everything we talked about today is connected to addictions versus mental health versus childhood diagnosis for behavioral problems. All of it is hooked together. It's like this great big chain, and it's not being handled exactly the way it should be handled. So they've opened up some doors to get input from other people, and I think it will make a big difference. They're trying. It's not like they're not trying. They really are trying. But you know, like everything else like this, it's going to take some serious tweaking, and that's what they're trying to do. So I want to say thanks to you girls for joining me today.
Thanks, Rainey. Thanks, Lisa. Glad you called in.
Yeah. And have a great day, and we'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Talk to you all in the morning.
Bye, Rainey. Bye, Shelley.
Bye, sweetie.